Steve, who's done an enormous amount of work on this a long time ago. I've been doing some work on this quite recently, but very little. So this is kind of work in progress, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to help me out in some ways. I'd also, like Steve, like to give a vote of thanks to a local historian who I don't know and who I suspect is no longer with us. I'd be really interested if anybody knows a man called knows of a man called John Mackeson, who in, I guess, the mid-70s, started doing some work on the radical 1790s in Bristol. A whole bunch of papers kind of came my way. They sort of washed up with me. I make great use of them. I think he's great, and I don't know anything about him. It seems from the context that he was a retired lawyer, so I guess he retired in the 70s and worked for 5 or 10 years. That may have been the end of it. But his stuff is great. What I was really going to do is zoom in on a particular bit of the story that Steve was talking about at a particular time frame, really the winter of 1795 through into 1796, which was a time when Bristol civil society organised itself in quite a determined manner in opposition to an unpopular government and an unpopular war. And I'd like to look at that through the lens of a couple of people who Steve's already mentioned, the radical Dr. Thomas Beddoes and the poet Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who both got involved. I'm kind of interested, having looked at the radicalism in the 1790s in other contexts, and particularly in London, how by the mid-1790s, normally what happens is, in the 1780s, political reform, which is called revolution in the language of the day, is quite a genteel movement. It's middle class, and it comes from areas which don't have a lot of representation inside the House of Commons, and it's very polite, and it's very formal, and it's very kind of don't frighten the horses, and sort of bien pensant. And that's a very different beast from the kind of radical crowd that we've been hearing about. Now, what happens in other places is that by 1794, that distinction is starting to collapse because a lot of the genteel reformers have been frightened off. There are various flashpoints in the autumn winter of 1793. There's a big convention in Edinburgh when a number of corresponding sort of constitutional societies get together and talk about forming a convention, an extra parliamentary forum where civil society can express itself. This is broken up by the police. This is on the orders of by the militias on the orders of Henry Dundas, who becomes Home Secretary, who really kind of wins his spurs as a draconian enforcer in Scotland. There's not much evidence that there was any serious unrest going on, but the meeting's broken up on grounds of disturbance of the peace. And a number of very middle-class reformers are prosecuted with really striking severity. Reverend Thomas Fish Palmer, who's an Anglican priest formerly of Eton and Cambridge, gets sentenced to 7 years transportation to Botany Bay. You know, he ends up, his ship gets hijacked, he ends up dying as a Spanish prisoner of war on Guam in the South Pacific. He was expecting, and all his friends were expecting at the most, a few days in prison, a little fine. You know, once you start doing that kind of thing, it's extraordinary how fast the middle class reformers peel away, and the number of people who were left after that point, were very small. I don't know whether that's the case in Bristol as well. I'd be interested to know whether there's a sense that, because I sense that, as Steve suggested, the story is rather different. The context we've had some of already in 1794, we're at war. In a very unpopular war, a war which is not, many feel, being fought in self-defence. It's been forced to put down this optimistic, ambitious and honourable French experiment in democracy, and it's being fought by Britain in alliance with repressive despotic regimes, the likes of Austria and Prussia and so on. As well as the war, we've had a bad harvest, and we've had a very, very cold winter. Taxes and conscription have both been massively increased. By June, as Steve's told us, bread is at famine prices, there's food riots in Bristol markets. People are being convicted and sentenced to death for stealing food. There's a very interesting sort of editorial thing which runs on 30th of July in the Bristol Gazette, which I think gives us a very interesting, sort of good concrete sense of what Bristol was like. It's called In the Time of Dearth, and it's a list of rules for the rich and rules for the poor. Rules for the rich: don't have gravy, don't have second courses, don't keep useless dogs, don't give dogs or any other animals bread or meat, you know, people want this stuff. Save all your skim milk and give it to the poor. Go to church yourselves and take care that your servants go to church constantly. Constantly in church, safest place to be. Prefer those poor who keep steadily to their work and go constantly to church, and give nothing to those who are idle or riotous or keep useless dogs. So this is how rich people are being told to behave. Rules for the poor: keep steady to your work and never change masters if you can help it. Go to no gin shop or alehouse, but lay out all you earn in food, clothes to yourself and family. Avoid bad company. Keep no dogs. Go constantly to church. Be civil to your superiors and they'll be kind to you. Learn how to make broth, milk porridge, rice pudding, etc. Be quiet and contented and never steal or swear, or you will never thrive. So that kind of says to me that this is a city where the social contract is breaking down in important ways. There are people living cheek by jowl, you know, some of whom are very rich and some of whom are very poor. You know, it's an exhortation to everybody to keep this working, to stop it breaking down in civil war. So that gives, I think, some kind of sense of what Bristol was like, you know, going through into the autumn of 1795, which was an autumn of enormous political discontent. In London, in October, a big demonstration outside Downing Street, large crowd shouting, no war, no Pitt, the Prime Minister, cheap bread and so on, throwing stones, breaking the Prime Minister's windows, our friend Colonel Despard among the rioters there, incidentally. At the end of October, the image that we saw of John Thirlwall at Copenhagen Fields, an enormous, great gathering, you know, who knows how many, tens of thousands, certainly. And 3 days after that, George III, in his carriage on the way to Parliament, attacked by a crowd, some of whom apparently are trying to drag him out of his carriage and beat him up. This is unheard of, and the royal carriage is bulletproofed after this point. So it's a very unstable time, and the real spur to civic action comes on the 6th of November, when Pitt's administration introduces two bills which come to be known, christened by Charles James Fox and the Whig opposition, as the gagging bills. These are the Treasonable Practices Bill, which basically extends the medieval code of treason to include intimidating Houses of Parliament. So this is a bill that means any extra parliamentary action, any attempts to force either House of Parliament to change their council, is now potentially treasonous. So any form of dissent expressed outside the parliamentary system is shading over into treason. The second bill is a Seditious Meetings Bill, which effectively assumes the illegality of all public meetings, and in any case limits them to less than 50. So what's happening here is that, you know, freedom of assembly and freedom of speech are being dramatically curtailed. And at the same time, as Steve pointed out, Bliss was in that dawn to be alive, the 1790s was a time of great possibility. It was also a time, particularly around this point, when people thought, well, actually, this is going to be our last chance to protest. You know, there's no guarantee. You know, we're in that sort of a very long drawn out war. We look like we're heading into this kind of martial lockdown where we're never ever going to have these rights again. So this is our last chance to change things. And it produced a huge ferment of public activity in Bristol. By the 17th of November, so, you know, less than a fortnight after the gagging bills were introduced, The Guild Hall had been hired for a meeting of the citizens of Bristol, which had been advertised by posters and handbills and so on. And this meeting was to debate two motions. The first, A, to congratulate His Majesty on his late providential escape from the attack and insult offered to his person, and to show their utmost abhorrence of such proceedings. As often in the 1790s, it's incredibly important for people involved in dissent or political protest to bend over backwards to say how loyal and how patriotic they are, and how this is not an attack on the Constitution. This is just a little bit of minor tinkering at the edges, which would just make our system a little bit more representative and just stop people from rising, you know, a little bit. And the second motion is to implore His Majesty to remove the present heavy calamities and distresses of the people by restoring them to the blessings of peace. So this is effectively an anti-war meeting. It's chaired by the Mayor of Bristol, James Harvey, at this point. And the hall is packed, allegedly, and it's clear from the opening addresses that a great majority were for peace. So this is essentially a large gathering of peace activists, into which a voice from the back shouts, "Mr. Mayor, Mr. Mayor, demands to speak." It's Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Coleridge, at this point, age 24, very young. He's been dragged to Bristol quite recently by Robert Southey. They're pursuing a scheme which they call Pantisocracy, which is essentially a utopian communal project for a couple of dozen of them to go over and to live in a utopian regime of shared property by the Susquehanna River in the States, where Priestley's gone into exile after the riots that we heard about. Coleridge, in later life, paints this as being a kind of absurd, you know, sort of young, utopian, impractical scheme. In fact, had he wanted to do it, it was perfectly plausible. Thousands did, he easily could have done. But at this point, in 1795, he's trying to raise money for it by lecturing. Well, he's lecturing in pubs like the Plume of Feathers in Wine Street, Pelican Inn in Thomas Street, rooms over the Corn Market, and so on. He's delivering political lectures which are attacking the government and the Pitt administration, accusing them of manufacturing conspiracies and stirring up fear of Jacobinism when there isn't any, and making essentially a very Christian case, which is sort of against war and against slavery. It obviously went down very well with some people. Some newspaper comments said, for example, that Coleridge was speaking in public what none had the courage in the city to do before. He told men that they had rights. But it seems that he was mostly preaching to the converted, to quite a small audience, so it was a grand and honourable tradition here. And some people, outsiders, were kind of less than overwhelmed. Some people had their minds blown, but the observer's comment was, "Mr. Coleridge would do well to appear with cleaner stockings in public." One of Coleridge's great targets was the slave trade, and again, you know, this is a contentious issue here, and it's one that he'll return to. When he stands up in the Guildhall on the 17th of November, he gives apparently the most fantastic speech. It must have been amazing to hear Coleridge talking in those days. You only had to be within kind of a certain radius of it, and it was of him, and it was bound to happen. He apparently just talked continuously and wove around while he talked and moved from subject to subject. It was like kind of listening to some enormously complicated symphony all the time. But it was, according to the Star in London, who reported on it, the most elegant and the most sublime address that was ever heard. He blamed the attack on George III on the war. The best method, he said, to prevent a repetition of such evils was to remove the cause. And he focused on the way in which the government was pretending that anybody who was a moderate reformer was in fact a dastardly Jacobin. The very means, he said, which government has taken to prevent Jacobinical principles were calculated to produce them. And he was very clear about directing his concerns towards the poor. He said, it's all very well, people have property and the middle classes complaining that, you know, their property is in danger. Well, yes it is, but they have property at stake, but the poorest subjects have most at stake, because they're the people who have their all. On the 17th of November, this motion was passed, but then there was a debate about what to do next. Should this be presented in form of petition? Should it be presented to Parliament? Should it be presented to the King? Another meeting was called at the Guildhall, in 3 days' time, on the 20th of November, to debate what to do with the agreement that they had. But also on the 17th of November, a pamphlet had emerged on the streets of Bristol. It was entitled A Word of Defence of the Bill of Rights Against the Gagging Bills, and this was written by Thomas Beddoes. Beddoes was at this point probably the most famous doctor or scientist in Bristol. He'd been a reader in chemistry at Oxford University, nearly a professor, but not for political reasons. He'd left after he'd published a defence of the September massacres. Oxford at that point was really a place where you went if you wanted to be a bishop. It was kind of very religious, it was very establishment. It was one of the first places to really swing behind the sort of Burkean reaction, swing to the right. Beddoes became more and more conspicuous as a partisan of the French Revolution, who was arguing quite correctly, in fact, that what we were reading in the Times was propaganda, and we should get some more impartial information before we decided what was actually going on in Paris. He moved to Bristol for various reasons. He wanted to practice, and he was very unusual in the medical profession at that time in being a doctor who believed that the main work of medicine was treating the poor. Medicine at this point was really kind of, in the absence of an NHS, it was a kind of a collusion between rich patients and greedy doctors. So there were very few resources for poor people. Beddoes was about the first person who spotted that the Industrial Revolution was started. It was creating slums and places where people were getting all manner of occupational diseases. He was noticing this in miners, and he was noticing this around the ports, particularly with tuberculosis and so on. His idea was that you should take medicine as a mission, and indeed that to do so was a political act, and it was probably a more effective political intervention than actually getting involved in politics. This is one of Beddoes' themes. In his Word of Defence of the Bill of Rights Against the Gagging Bills, he appealed, as all reformers do at this point, to venerable tradition. The inhabitants of Great Britain, he says, have enjoyed in a superior degree the use of reason and speech, the two great faculties by which the Almighty has distinguished man from brute creation. Beddoes could not have cared less about the Almighty. He was probably the most sort of out atheist that you could possibly imagine in the 1790s, but when he's writing to the public, it's always about God. This inheritance we derive from our ancestors, this is the notion that these are not newfangled foreign liberties from across the Channel. These are traditional Anglo-Saxon liberties that we always had. And in fact, before the Norman yoke was imposed on us, we had them even more strongly. These are our inheritance and our birthright. A nation that slumbers over its rights, he says, will be fortunate if it does not awake in fetters. To surrender this right would be deliberate political suicide. Good stuff, and it's an interesting conclusion at the end. He says it's not known until the last minute whether Guildhall is going to be available for this kind of meeting. But at the end, Beddoes says, citizens, good, he would call everyone citizens, citizens, let not petty difficulties prevent the exercise of your rights. Assemble, if you can find no other place, in Queen Square. So in the 1790s too, the idea was if it really comes to the wire, then everybody just goes to Queen Square. That seems to have been understood. 3 days later, 20th of November, there was a large crowd at the Guildhall and a large crowd outside. There was a militia parading around in the streets. There was a drum beating to arms outside the Guildhall, and there were, quote, vast numbers of handbills being distributed to prevent the Friends of Peace from attending. So in these 3 days, once it was, as Steve indicated as well, the forces of reaction are out on the streets just as fast and usually in greater numbers than the forces of revolution at this point. The meeting, however, was extremely well behaved, not the smallest appearance of confusion, we hear. There was a debate then on the propriety of petitioning Parliament against certain bills now pending in the House of Commons, the gagging bills. This was chaired by a man called Dr. Edward Long Fox, who was another incomer. He was a Cornish Quaker, who'd been breaking into the Bristol monopolies for a while. In 1786, he'd become the first doctor who was not from Bristol to be appointed at the Royal Infirmary. In 1793, he opened a humane private lunatic asylum at Fishbourne. The Quakers at this point were real pioneers in the humane treatment of the mentally ill. They had the York retreat that they opened outside York. was the model for it, and they were the only people who were offering an alternative to the state asylums, of which were very few, Bedlam and so on. And he was also, he'd also in 1793 during the Bristol Bridge riots had agitated for a public meeting to call the corporation to account, resolve the Bristol Bridge dispute and so on. He called for a petition which was approved unanimously, but then the debate was about what should be done with this petition from the citizens of Bristol against the war. Should it be presented, as Thomas Beddoe suggested, by the MPs from Bristol? In response to the suggestion, there was a partial show of hands and some hissing. There was obviously no great love lost between the Bristol citizens and their MPs. Until it was explained that by doing so, this would by no means pledge themselves to support these MPs at a future election, nor in any wise testify in approbation of their past conduct. And after this, it was reluctantly agreed that the petition should be presented to the Bristol MPs to be presented to Parliament. So this was, I guess, the sort of high point of Bristol's public anti-war campaign, the 20th of November. And the forces of reaction were already mobilising. By the 11th of December, there were pamphlets going round, an anonymous one signed AW, there's been a lot of debate about who AW was, and you probably know who it was, which was called a letter to Edward Fox, MD, but it also had Beddoes and Coleridge in its sight. It accused Fox and Beddoes and these other factious aliens, as it calls them, of inciting the citizens of Bristol to mislead their judgment, inflame their passions and excite their resentment. Effectively, these are liberal, middle-class outsiders who don't share Bristolian values, who are stirring up an ignorant Bristol populace. And as professionals, these people are all professionals, teachers and doctors and so on, they should be aware, according to AW, of how much more passion than reason falls to the lot of the lower ranks in every society. But it concludes optimistically that the citizens of Bristol have more spirit and prudence than to suffer a few factious aliens to scatter among them the seeds of sedition and discord. So this is a kind of bubble which builds and then bursts. And 18th of December, the gagging bills are passed into law in Parliament. They've become called the Two Acts. But there's the momentum of political protest that's built up behind them. People are still trying to harness. 2 days later, Thomas Erskine, who's a Whig MP and barrister who defends Thomas Hardy in the London Correspondence Society against charges of high treason, as well as defending Tom Paine, stands up at the Whig Club and says that every friend of freedom should act now as a species of watchman to protect Britain's constitutional rights, which are in danger. A few days later, there's a meeting at the Rummer Tavern where Coleridge is encouraged to start a periodical doing this, being a watchman and holding the government to account. He calls this publication The Watchman. Its banner motto is that all may know the truth and that the truth may make us free. And it's launched in March 1796. And in fact, in the reference library now, you can see a copy of the original edition in a little glass case there. They've got it out to tie in with this series of events. It's kind of an interesting journal. It's a mixture of political essays and poetry and reviews of books. They've got a big sections on foreign intelligence and domestic intelligence, which are really kind of clippings and roundups from newspapers in London and Paris and so on, which suggests that it's quite hard to get impartial news in Bristol. You can put a certain amount on your circulation just by reprinting a lot of this other stuff, handbills and so on. It's got some good bits of writing by Coleridge. One of the best maybe being the one on which the page on which it's open in Bristol Reference Library actually, which is Peace on the Slave Trade, as ever a conscientious issue in Bristol. But what's interesting, the context of talking, what we're talking about this week is the way in which Coleridge relates the condition of slavery to the condition of the working poor in London, which is an equation which isn't always made. It has been asserted, he tells us, by more than one writer on the subject that the plantation slaves are at least as well off as our peasantry in England. Now I appeal to common sense, whether to affirm that the slaves are as well off as our peasantry be not the same as to assert that our peasantry are as bad off as Negro slaves, and whether, if our peasantry believed it, they would not be inclined to rebel. So the Watchman was kind of, Coleridge was very worried launching it, that he was going to be prosecuted, because it seemed to be that the gagging bills had been brought in to prevent precisely this kind of publication. But at the same time, he felt it was his duty, his civic duty, and also his moral and religious duty, to test the new laws. And it kind of succeeded, the Watchman, in being radical, though it's not really in a... Coleridge was never really Jacobinical. It's more kind of Christian. You have to think that his plan B at the moment, at this point, you know, if the utopian commune and the Susquehanna didn't come off, his plan B was to be a dissenting minister. You know, the poet wasn't kind of quite there yet, and you can really see how he could have stood up and kind of just made wonderful moral and religious appeals for a living. And there's a lot of that in The Watchman, but so it's not really the kind of incisive Jacobinism that it could be. But within the course of this, he attacks Pitt pretty relentlessly. He calls the two acts unconstitutional. He declares that property is theft from the poor. He looks forward to the overthrow of monarchs and despots. He supports the rights of man, and he actually, even though Joseph Cottle, kind of his publisher, complained that he didn't deal with more Bristol local issues, being an outsider, he does mount a little local campaign on behalf of a brewer called William Gage, who was arrested in the food riots in June and sentenced to death. And the week after, Coleridge runs a piece questioning this judgment in The Watchman. Gage's sentence does get transmuted to transportation. So there's a little bit of local campaigning in there as well. But Watchman wasn't a success financially. It started with about 500 subscribers who'd been whipped up from not just Bristol but other dissenting centres, Erasmus Darwin in Lichfield and Birmingham and so on. It kind of starts to fall. I think really because despite everybody's attempts to keep it going, the activist momentum of the previous winter of 1795 is really ebbing away at this point. And part of the reason it's ebbing away is that the gagging bills, the two acts, have been passed. But another part is that political directions are becoming less clear. Firstly, one of the great calls in 1795 was that Pitt should seek peace with France. Well, by 1796 he started opening peace negotiations with France, so you can't really complain about that anymore. But also at the same time, the French Directory, which was established in October 1795, about the same time as the Copenhagen Fields gatherings and so on, has started. This is what's taken over after Robespierre's execution, Napoleon's part of the Directory. France is generally becoming more militarised. It's instituted censorship, it's banned political meetings. In other words, the situation in France is now the same situation here after the two acts, and this is what will become a very repetitive story for the next while, is that France and French and British politics, which at the beginning of the 1790s were completely different, there's a real choice there between two alternatives. Now they're both becoming more militarised, they're both becoming more centralised, they're both becoming more repressive. It looks like there's nowhere to go. Generally speaking, the quality of The Watchman dropped, partly because the deadlines are very tight. He was publishing every 8 days. If he published every 7 days as a weekly, you had to pay extra stamp tax, so he published every 8 days. But it was a lot of work. He didn't really have money to pay subscribers, so he was kind of writing everything himself. You start to see more and more recycled stuff. And it signs off gloomily after issue 10. His last words are, "O Watchman, thou hast watched in vain." So what happens, just finally, as a kind of coder, I'm always interested in what happens to people, where these kind of, where this energy goes, when you get these crescendos and climaxes and falling aways of political activism. And I think you get sort of two contrasting stories with Coleridge and Beddoes, which makes them worth following. Coleridge moves towards a kind of quietism, which Steve mentioned again. Politics has basically become a choice between the repressive monarchy here in Britain and the military dictatorship in France, and that choice, that remains the choice for a very long time. So a lot of people figure in different ways that the best thing to do is just to back off, to retreat from political engagement, and to live an ethical life. In Coleridge's case, he moves out to Nether Stowey and sort of does his peasant thing for a while. But really for him it's a kind of a stepping stone to reaction. What he comes out of at the other side of this quietism is the idea that actually what we need to do is reconstitute this kind of Christian paternalism. The trouble is, you know, what's happened is that, you know, the upper and middling classes aren't doing their duty to the poor. In other words, the position that Coleridge ends up coming to is very much the position implied in that rules for the rich, rules for the poor, from the Bristol Gazette. Thomas Beddoes goes in a very different direction, and he returns to treating the poor, but that's really kind of his prime directive. In 1796 he writes a very good essay on the public merits of Mr. Pitt, which is a kind of critique of Pitt's view of politics and where it's going to lead us. And he starts with a story of a friendly lady repeating to him some criticism of him that she'd overheard. She'd overheard someone saying, "So, Dr. Beddoes was at a meeting of this committee last night. Bless me, suppose he'd been suddenly wanted. The poor patient might have perished before he could be called. I wonder what a physician has to do with politics." And this is kind of a joke, but it also was something serious to Beddoes, you know, that actually he should be healing the sick, but also that it would be possible if he could really get the civic society to engage with public health in the way he wanted, that would actually revolutionise and transform society in the way that people wanted out of politics. Edward Long Fox, you know, similarly to Beddoes, also goes back into being a doctor. He opens a bigger asylum at Bridlington in 1804. But Beddoes stays treating the Bristol poor. He coins the term preventive medicine and a lot of what we now call environmental health. So the whole idea that actually health should not be just about treating people who are ill on the basis of how much they could pay, but keeping the health of the nation up to a certain level for much broader social benefits. He's kind of really battering away at that. It's quite a lonely mission, and his life becomes pessimistic up until his death in 1808. And kind of in the stuff that he's writing up until 1808, it does become kind of gloomier and it does become darker, and you get a sense he kind of repeatedly refers back to the middle of the 1790s and the sense that there was a radical moment there that had been lost. You know, that was the one point when something could have been done. Okay, maybe nothing could have been done, but that was the point when everybody had to try, and when that point was passed, then we'd gone forward into a world where it was not possible to try that kind of thing again. And I guess he was right, that radical moment was lost, and it wouldn't return until it did so in a different way in 1831. But that's a different story with a different ending as well for later in the week. Thanks very much.
Thanks very much for listening. If you've got some questions that you've thought about,